Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power. With your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining me shortly will be my friend and colleague from American Thinker, Rich Bear. He's a political correspondent there. And then joining us a little later will be Joel Pollack, editor-at-large at Breitbart and a former congressional candidate. We're going to talk about Prime Minister Netanyahu's historic speech before a joint session of Congress today, which I don't think anybody was surprised how good it was. I'm kind of surprised at the reception it received, even among his critics, which was largely positive, at least as far as the rhetoric and the emotion went. But we'll talk about all that. Now I'd like to bring on my co-host for this evening, Rich Bear. Rich, how's it going?
Doing fine. Can you hear me?
I can hear you great. That's better than your landline, brother.
I should dump it and become a 20-year-old.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Before we begin, we must mark the occasion, gather around the campfire singing sad songs of the death of kings. Derrick Rose and Patrick Kane go down. And then a week later, Jimmy Butler goes down. So the Bulls and the Hawks are in deep, deep trouble. And, I called it the worst day in the history of Chicago sports.
It was certainly up there. I think both teams were a little bit overrated this year in terms of their prospects for a deep playoff run. They've both been inconsistent. The Bulls have always been a defensive-minded team the last few years. This year they were giving up over 100 points a game. And the Blackhawks had played sort of down to their level of competition a lot, had some nice streaks. But the idea of winning three or four straight series with the other team having home ice advantage in every series, that would have been a stretch this year, I think.
Yeah, looks like it. Well, it'll still be fun. I mean, they're fun to watch. I like both teams. They're fun to watch, so we'll have fun.
How long is Butler?
Before we get into 3 to 6 weeks.
3 to 6 also. Okay.
It's almost the same as Rose. So they'll make the playoffs, but they'll be like a 6th seed, I'll bet. 6th,
yeah.
Maybe even 7th. We'll see. Okay, so we're going to talk about Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech when Joel comes on. I don't want to have him miss anything. In the meantime, we can talk about the travesty that occurred in the House of Representatives today, the total, complete cave-in by Speaker of the House, mm-hmm. John Boehner, on DHS funding and the executive orders on immigration that will now be fully funded. He went out with a whimper, didn't he, Richard?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things going on. The first is, the good news was the recent court decision, which again is a district court level, not an appeals court yet, which basically nullified Obama's executive actions. And there is, as a result, probably less pressure on Congress to do something because the administration seems to have indicated that, at least for the time being while they appeal, they're not going to break the law or at least do it visibly. Maybe they'll get caught next year for what they did this year by breaking the law, but we don't know that. But I think the problem with what happened in the House is that you just don't have a strategy. I mean, the Republicans knew from November on that they were going to have majorities in both houses. They knew how strong those majorities were. They knew that if they pass something, it's going to get vetoed. They understand in the Senate they need 60 on some votes. They understand overrides take 67. But in any case, you got to have a strategy that involves the leaders and essentially pretty broad consensus of the membership in both bodies. And I don't get any sense that that there had been any sort of strategy or plan put in place for how they were going to play this out. So am I surprised that they capitulated? No. The other thing I tell you, though, is I don't think very many people were paying a lot of attention. I don't think this was the same as the shutdown, you know, a year ago when the same time Obamacare was starting and rolling out, and this sort of became the story rather than the failure of the Obamacare website. This one I don't think got quite the same attention other than from conservative partisans, and I'm sure they're steaming.
Yeah, I was expecting calls for a third party by the end of today, given the
I'm sure Mark Levin will be ready. Yeah,
sure. You know, this decision by the judge is very curious in that it was not adjudicated on the basis of the constitutionality of the president's actions. It was an obscure administrative law rule that they didn't publish the orders in the Federal Register 60 days prior to their inaction. So I don't know how that's going to stand up on appeal. I would imagine administration lawyers will find a way to finagle themselves around it. But having said that, you've been around courts most of your life. What's your sense of the future of this court case?
Yeah, I don't know the particular circuit that this one is in, but Obama, as a result of getting rid of the filibuster for judicial appointments below the Supreme Court level, has managed to pack enough Democrats onto the courts that I think the Democrats, the liberals anyway, now control either 9 of 13 or 10 of 14. The D.C. circuit, maybe the 14th. So unless this is one of sort of the southern circuits that still retain the conservative majority, and there's a reasonable chance, given that a fair number of justices these days at all levels seem to know who appointed them and act appropriately, that you know this one could get overthrown. The point I make, though, and your point's an interesting one, is that much like the Burwell case. On the federal exchanges and whether subsidies can be paid out, sometimes these small errors or failure to correct them can be disastrous. And if you have people just applying essentially the law as written without looking at political consequence or economic consequence, there's a chance you can win on what seem to be pretty insignificant areas.
Yeah, well, you don't expect Sotomayor or Kagan or any of the other liberal justices to fall for
Ginsburg
this. Now,
and
do you?
No. The conservatives, if they can put together, you know, Kennedy and Roberts to stay with the three conservatives, Alito and Thomas and Scalia, you know, they can eke out a 5-4 majority on some cases. It looks like they had that on the Obamacare case last year, and then Roberts
gave it up. Yeah.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see how he reacts to this one, because he has to be, I would think, annoyed with how the administration has behaved since he gave them a big one last year on that decision. And, you know, if you think about it, he may look at the immigration bill, and that can influence how he acts now on Obamacare. Because if you just read the law as written, you can make a pretty good case, even though the left is going absolutely insane about this, assuming that it has to be thrown out because you're going to put 8 million people, you know, and they're going to lose their subsidies, and It's going to greatly increase, you know, their insurance costs by double or triple and so on. But that's really not the issue. That's an issue for Congress, not an issue for the court. So we'll see whether Roberts just decides that he sort of had enough of this sort of extra-legal framework, and, you know, especially in Obamacare, where they've changed the law 20, 30 times administratively already.
Right. Well, I'm just curious because, you know, you say the court doesn't pay. The court pays attention. The Supreme Court especially pays attention.
Sure.
To the politics thing.
Correct.
And
correct.
I think one of Roberts' major problems was that they had spent, what, $3, $4 billion implementing Obamacare already by the time the decision was handed down. So,
right.
You know, you've got to make a decision. You know, do you stop this thing in its tracks and have all this money wasted? And plus, I guess some people were already involved in the risk pools and getting insurance that way. So, you know, there is, and this is huge. Now, the Republicans have come up with an alternative that they hope the Supreme Court will read, at least the swing votes there that you mentioned, and will feel safe in striking down the subsidies.
Right.
I don't see that happening. I don't think the Republican alternative, from what I've read, does the job. It's a mess, is what it is. And I think we're stuck with the darn thing for forever. So we'll have to see about it.
The way I read the at least one of the alternatives was that they provided the equivalent of an ERISA guarantee that you could maintain, you know, the coverage you had for 18 months at and that the subsidy would continue for that 18-month period.
Okay.
But that would carry you through essentially the beginnings, because the decision won't be reached till June, of a new administration, which Republicans, you know, hope against hope, think they can still win a presidential election, which we'll see if that's the case. But obviously, as long as you have a Democrat in the White House, you're not going to get legislation passed unless you're dealing with the fallout. And I think Obama would be under a lot of pressure not to just let Republicans, you know, sort of stew in their juices that they finally threw out a major section of Obamacare, but would be forced to work with them for some sort of, you know, reconstructive surgery on the program.
Well, reconstructive needs transplants. The darn thing is just killing the insurance business. And of course, it's you would not. I had to get Obamacare insurance this year. You wouldn't believe what I had to go through to get it. I still have. Oh, by the way, I signed up for it on February 15th. I still haven't gotten my insurance packet. I still haven't been able to pay my first month's premium because the insurance company refuses to get in touch with me. Just incredible.
Lovely.
Anyway, I'm not going to go into my own personal travails here because it's just ridiculous. So anyway, just back to immigration for one more second, this DHS thing. You're right in that there didn't seem to be a big blow-up about it, except in conservative circles. But maybe that's Beebe's speech overshadowing everything. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. Especially, you know, among my crowd, you know, who's been obsessing about Iran and the deal that's on the table or appears to be imminent and all the hoopla about Beebe's, you know, upcoming speech and the destructive impact it's had on bipartisanship in the Congress when, in fact, there's nothing the Obama team wanted more than to have an opportunity to finally pull left-wing Democrats away from support for Israel. I mean, I think this has been in the cards all along. That's just the reality. And but I think it's become such a big story, the politics about Beebe's speech, will he give it, will he not give it, how bad are U.S.-Israel relations now under Obama, what could happen the next 2 years, that this story became much reduced in terms of the TSA and Homeland Security. I mean, I had a ride to the airport last week, another consultant after a case I did in Kentucky, and he was asking me about whether the the Homeland Security bill, you know, what's happening. And I have to admit, I haven't been following it. It wasn't my top of mind issue. You know, it might have been a CPAC, but not for me.
Yeah. You know, in addition to not having a strategy, they had no message. They had no, you know, the Democrats have been very, very good about staying on message. All of them, mm-hmm. no matter where they are, mm-hmm. who they talk to, mm-hmm. who arrests, mm-hmm. they are on message. And the Republicans were all over the lot. And I think that was a big difference, too.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, you know, the Republicans really are more divided on this. That's the problem.
I don't think anybody was divided as far as not wanting, you know, wanting to fund the executive orders. I think that was pretty universal,
sure.
wasn't it? I mean,
right.
The question was, they were divided on strategy, is what you're saying, right?
Right. I mean, they're also divided on what essentially is the likelihood of winning, as opposed to the likelihood of taking a stand for which you're going to get embarrassed and lose.
Yeah.
And there are people who are more sort of, this is not going to turn out to be a win for us, so let's get it done.
Yeah. We're anticipating a call from Joel Pollack, editor-at-large at Breitbart. He should be calling in any minute.
Okay.
In the meantime, there is more going on in Washington than the speech. There is some pushback now on this Iran deal that Kerry, for instance, met three times today with the Iranian foreign minister, Mr. Sabir, who we understand from reports, both from Iranian sources and from Western sources, this guy would stand up and brutalize Kerry in these negotiations. He would scream at him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think of any other American negotiator in history who would sit there and take that.
Yeah, I mean,
the guy was absolutely screaming at him. I mean, just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, so given that, what's the likelihood about which side will be making the meaningful concessions to get a deal accomplished? I mean, you don't really have to ask very much. The desperation is on the side that has more leverage in the negotiations because the price of oil has dropped in half. So you got a country that's reeling a little bit from sanctions. Their major export product is now half price. And we're the ones reducing the period of time for the restrictions to remain in place, allowing increases in the number of centrifuges that can still be operating. I mean, it's kind of astonishing. I mean, there's a zeal to get a deal. And when that happens, the side that's desperate loses.
Well, sure. I mean, and the reason we're desperate isn't because we need the deal. We're desperate because, number one, Obama doesn't want to go to war. And number two, he wants something historic. He wants mm-hmm. to be remembered as the man who opened the path to peace with the Iran. Well, you know, that's a hell of a reason to have a deal. And it's a hell of a reason to give in on all these issues. And I really hope Joel is okay. Prime Minister Netanyahu opened up when he talked about
Joel has the number, correct?
Oh yeah, I sent it. I said he responded to the emails. I assume he had it.
Okay. Sorry about that.
But what Prime Minister Netanyahu is basically saying is that the President of the United States is wrong. Mm-hmm. A bad deal is worse than no deal.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama is saying, well, you know, what Prime Minister Netanyahu wants is impossible. That was a direct mm-hmm. quote from the White House. He wants impossible. He wants, you know, permanent regime change. Well,
But that again, in other words, the American negotiating position is the Iranians won't stand for it, so we're not going to push it. The Iranian position is the Americans will cave every time we make a demand. So demand.
Right. I mean, it's remarkable. If you just take a very short history lesson here, for 10 years, U.S. policy was that we don't talk to Iran until they stop enriching uranium. That was our policy. Then they negotiated this interim agreement that Iran has violated many times over. Two huge mm-hmm. violations, including upgrading their centrifuge technology. They could not mm-hmm. do that in the interim agreement, although they said they can. And the second thing mm-hmm. is that they promised by last August to come clean on all the military infrastructure that they built up in their nuclear program. They have yet to do that, mm-hmm. says the IAEA just yesterday, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said.
And they say, they're now saying, arguing that missiles are entirely outside the agreement. We have no say on that.
That's incredible. I mean, which means that warhead development is off the table too. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing the IAEA wanted to know, and Iran is not telling them. This is shaping up to be an unmitigated disaster. And, of course, the president has said that this is not going to be a treaty. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an agreement. Well, there's no such thing mm-hmm. in diplomatic circles as an agreement. You have memorandums of understanding. You have demarches. You have all sorts of stuff. You don't have agreements. You either have a treaty or you don't. And, mm-hmm. of course, if it was a treaty, you'd have to take it to the Senate. And the Senate ratified.
And if you take it to the Senate, then you have to get 2/3 of them to support you. If you, on the other hand, go the approach that the Senate's taking now, the White House can veto that requirement that the Senate get to review the bill, and then the Republicans, the opposition, including Democrats like Menendez, have to get 2/3 to override, which is much harder. In other words, if the side that's opposing the president has to get 2/3, that's a lot tougher than if all they need to do is prevent the administration from getting 2/3 on a treaty, which is pretty easy. They only need 34 votes for that, and that's probably in the bag.
Yeah. I just sent an email to Joe with the numbers in case he lost it or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So we might as well get started on the discussion here of Prime
sure.
Minister Netanyahu's speech.
Mm-hmm.
I think if there's a term to apply to it, it would be moral clarity.
Mm-hmm.
This speech gave a moral case for not only the survival of Israel, but the survival of the West and mm-hmm. the survival of freedom. And mm-hmm. you really yearn sometimes to hear our leaders, and I'm not picking on Obama. I think mm-hmm. American presidents have way too much nuance, if you will,
mm-hmm.
going
mm-hmm.
for them, and mm-hmm. Fail in this idea of delivering a case for their position with moral clarity. And certainly, Prime Minister Netanyahu did that. And by the way, somebody just called in. Joel, is that you?
Hi, it's Joel Pollack calling from California.
Yes, Joel. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
I got worried about you. I sent you another email.
Well, I'm so used to Chicago time that I mistook your time for Central rather than Eastern. So there you go.
Oh, okay. You're on with Rich Bear of the American Thinker.
Old friend.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, Joel, we just started the discussion, in fact, on the Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech, and I made the point that the best way to describe it was a speech of moral clarity, in that he gave a rousing, excellent, impassioned defense of Israel and their right to exist, as well as the right of the West and everybody else to have freedom from this terrorist state. I'm just wondering if you'd like to comment on that.
Well, from my point of view, I thought the speech was excellent. I thought that it did what it had to do the question is really what is the next step, because it's not clear that Congress has a next step yet. So on the one hand, he put his case very well. On the other hand, you know, President Obama still holds the cards in terms of veto power and negotiation. So we'll see what happens.
Yes.
I thought one thing that did change today is what I'll call the momentum moving forward has sort of been taken away from the administration. And they now, I think, are going to be under some pressure because of a perception that the deal is a weak one from our side's needs and Israel's needs. The concessions that have been sort of leading to the deals that have already been struck may become more difficult. So the question is, will Iran walk away if the U.S. stiffens a little bit? Is it even possible for the U.S. to stiffen at this point, since bringing Iran into the community of nations and and getting them to some sort of nuclear agreement and having them fight in Iraq instead of American forces, which seems to be another Obama goal, whether we'll just continue down the merry path and he'll ignore public opinion polls, which I guess will be very favorable towards the Netanyahu speech. I mean, I talked to a lot of people today in various parts of the country. Some of them were at airports, some of them were at their club, and they said people were just gripped by this. I mean, people stopped doing what they were doing. They watched this speech, and some of them were in largely non-Jewish audiences, and people were nodding their heads. They were very positive about it because it was just sort of a common sense approach. It was laid out with some humility. It was an attempt to get past the political divide, which I think was a manufactured crisis, not one really Netanyahu sought. And if anything, it has not helped him in the public opinion polls in Israel. So that was a nonsense argument. The whole protocol thing was a nonsense argument. But Obama really has sought to move Democrats to the left, and if you move to the left, you become less sympathetic to Israel. So I think this was a crisis he seized on. But there was legitimate fear because he knew Netanyahu would make a good case. He would have preferred that Netanyahu not speak. And the fact that he has spoken, you could see how tepid was his response, how the administration started walking things back a little bit in the last day or two because of some of the over-the-top comments last week by Susan Rice and others. And Kerry at in the House committee accusing Netanyahu of being responsible for the Iraq war. So I think they're on their heels a little bit, which is not a position they're used to. So we'll see what goes from here. I think Democrats realize they looked foolish with the boycott. I mean, they effectively signed up for the BDS movement, including six Jewish members of Congress. Just appalling behavior.
Yeah. What do you think, Joel? Do you think that the needle moved at all on sanctions, new sanctions? They're talking about imposing them if the deal falls through by June 30th. Do you think the move?
I don't think so. I don't think so, because I think what happened on that issue was Obama was able to divide his own party successfully and in sufficient numbers that it becomes harder to get to 2/3 to override a veto.
Right.
But where I do think the action is going to be next week in the Senate when Bob Corker's bill comes to the floor. That's the bill that requires any Iran deal to be reviewed by the Senate. And it's got bipartisan sponsorship. And Corker's office actually told me today that they will see that bill come to the floor next week and come to a vote. And that, I think, is where the momentum is going to go from here. And that's going to be harder for the left to resist because right now, remember, they're arguing against...
That's right.
Right. Well, they're also arguing against fast-track trade negotiations, saying that Obama should not be allowed to negotiate trade deals on his own. So the answer from Corker is going to be, well, if you think that trade is too important to trust Obama, why would you think nuclear weapons are less important?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's going to be the upshot of all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that one, too, will require a 2/3 override in both houses, is my understanding. Because Obama says he'll veto it.
Yes, that's right.
But
he said last week he would veto it. But I think that's where you'll see the override, because it's not it's not as heavy a lift. It's also harder to argue that it's going to be detrimental to negotiations. Remember, one of the arguments against the sanctions bill is that it could disrupt the atmosphere of negotiations by punishing Iran before the talks are over. That argument's unavailable on the culture bill because that's just totally internal to the United States itself. Of course it's going to affect the deal, but that's something that doesn't affect Iran directly, so it doesn't send a bad signal. It just says our Constitution requires that the Senate participate in treaties, that it approve treaties by two-thirds vote. You know, we have divided authority on foreign policy. It's never quite been settled, but we want to settle it in this particular direction. And, you know, the administration's not going to like it, but I think that's actually the end result of all this.
And I think it's difficult for members of Congress in either body to say we don't have any authority to review an agreement of this kind. I mean, that's, I think, not something they're willing to give up going forward, because there can always be presidents of different political parties.
Yeah, that's for sure. Let me switch gears here a little bit, play devil's advocate, or maybe more succinctly, look at the problem of Iran from the administration's point of view. Bibi got off a great line: "The enemy of my enemy is still my enemy." I like that. Was good. But the Obama administration doesn't quite see it like that. They think they can get Iran's help to solve the Syrian civil war, get help in Lebanon to settle things down there. Of course, in Iraq, where they're virtually taking over the Iraqi army, from what I've read recently. And of course in Yemen, where the Houthis are making trouble for everybody. Their point of view is that Iran can do all these things to help us, and then they're going to be a stabilizing influence. I'm sure we've all read that somewhere in the Middle East. Joel, is that a legitimate point of view at all, or is that just pie-in-the-sky naivete?
Well, it's pie-in-the-sky. You know, the argument presumes that Iran has an interest in cooperating with us that is separate from its interest in fighting ISIS. It has an interest in fighting ISIS quite independently of anything that we do. So the idea that we would trade away something to get their cooperation on ISIS is just silly. Now, there's the example of World War II, where we worked with Stalin and the communist regime in the Soviet Union, which was an ideological foe, to defeat a common enemy, and that's true, but it didn't start out that way. It only happened that way once Stalin was fearing defeat and had lost millions of people and soldiers and so on, and Hitler was basically closing in. So, you know, you have a situation where what Obama wants to do is create what he calls a new equilibrium in the Middle East, where he wants to balance the Shia powers against the Sunni powers on the understanding that this will kind of absent the United States or excuse the United States from any direct involvement. And it's a very nice idea, except that the other side of the equation doesn't want to be balanced. And that's why Netanyahu was very effective today. We've seen bits and pieces of his arguments all over the press, in different people's mouths, but he pulled them all together in one presentation today and talked about how Iran is advancing on a variety of fronts, not just the nuclear weapons, but also human rights, not just human rights, but also four Arab capitals, not just four Arab capitals, but American interests that it's attacking and American soldiers and so forth. So that's one of the issues. Iran is conducting a campaign of conquest, he said, and it's not something the United States can afford to wait until it's too late. And I think that's what won't balance in the Obama equilibrium. That's why Obama's vision is utopian, because Iran is going to fight ISIS, but they don't need the United States to help them fight ISIS. And in fact, the more they fight ISIS, the more they replace us in Iraq, the more they back up their forces in Syria, the more they project force to Israel's border and closer to Europe, actually, because they can move some of their missile installations into areas of Syria and Iraq under their control. So we're talking about a war that's being waged against us, whether we like it or not. And I think that's the picture Netanyahu painted today. It's really too late to stuff that genie back in the bottle. I mean, it's already happening. So given that it's happening, what do you do about it? Do you give them everything they want or close to everything they want in exchange for sort of a symbolic display of peace and understanding? Or do you recognize the threat for what it is? And that's what Netanyahu put in front of the country today.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'd also say that over the last few months, the what I'll call the noxious or toxic side of Iran has been downplayed. And, you know, there's been the new smokescreen about sort of strategic understandings or strategic alliances. The Michael Duran article, I think it was in Mosaic, was terrific about sort of 5 or 6 years about how this has been in progress and how members of the foreign policy establishment have actually supported this and think it's a really good idea. It's Machiavellian. It's 19th century European in terms of thinking big. And Obama is striking out and trying to, you know, bring the country into the community of nations, and they're not the bad guy anymore. The bad guy is ISIS, and we're both sort of aligned in that struggle. And that has been, I think, quite successful. And the administration stays on message. There's no real radical Islam, but there are bad guys, and we have to find, you know, some way to find jobs for them so they don't join up with ISIS. But ISIS is the problem. And those jobs, by the way, have to be equal wages for women. That's very important, too. We cannot have a gender gap on the jobs for jihadis. That's, I think, an important part of our program going forward. But the, but I think he's been successful. I think Iran is not the bogeyman it was 2, 3, 4 years ago. ISIS has become essentially the order of the day. And if they hadn't started slaughtering the Yazidis in Iraq, I don't think most Americans would have even been aware of what they were doing. I mean, why would they be in the news and not Boko Haram? I mean, are they worse? It was the slaughter of the Christians and the fact that it looked like a whole bunch of thousands of people were going to get wiped out that sort of forced Obama's hand on that. I don't think he would have even entered that conflict otherwise. We wouldn't have been alive. It just would have been an Iranian action, and they have the ability to be more lethal if we're not in the conflict directly. They can be as,
right,
as nasty as the people they're fighting. So I think what Netanyahu did today is he brought Iran back front and center as an evil country with evil intentions, not just for Israel, but people in the region. And that was very effective. And that's going to make it more difficult to sort of sell this breakthrough deal, because people are going to be more skeptical about Iran and who's actually benefiting from a deal. That was a major achievement today.
Yeah. I was screaming at the television this morning in the lead-up to the speech. I was watching CNN, and they had that, I think his name is Philippe, who's the editor of a foreign affairs magazine. And he says, you've got 11 countries that are enriching uranium right now. 11 countries. Are we supposed to tell Iran that they're not supposed to enrich uranium? Well, the simple answer to that question, of course, is yes. I mean, he says, well, you know, why should Iran be any different? Well, Iran is different. They don't, those 11 other countries don't have people in their national government, their leaders, talking about wiping Israel off the face of the earth. They don't have Friday prayers ending in death to America. I mean, there is a difference between other countries that mm-hmm. enrich uranium and Iran, and I don't see how you can have a blind spot in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Thanks for letting me get that off my chest. I've been wanting to do it all day because I was screaming at the TV by myself.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about
Sue,
that,
I thought one of the best points that Netanyahu made was reading the Twitter feed of Iranian leaders, pointing out mm-hmm. they don't have free internet in Iran, and yet they're tweeting in English about how they want to destroy Israel. I think mm-hmm. that was very effective. I think people remembered that. And
and the bombing of the U.S. ship, the fake bombing of the ship over the weekend. That was
that's
a good
right.
one to get
yeah.
out there for the
right
20, 30 million people watching us.
You know, I have to say, I think one of the reasons it went the way it did was that I think the Obama administration and the Democrats in Congress and the media feeding off each other had demonized Netanyahu and made him into an aggressor. That was the word Dianne Feinstein used. He's arrogant, destructive, said Susan Rice. You know, he was coming across as a villain. And one thing I realized when I watched the AIPAC speech yesterday, which was also one of his finest speeches, was that he was going to come across as a reasonable person, and this was going to be a big problem for Obama and for the Democrats, because they have played it up so much that he's an enemy almost of them and their party, that they came out looking ridiculous. And the press conference by the boycotters, which I almost boycotted just on principle, was interesting because they were really grasping at straws. They had to complain about things he had not actually said. For example, I think it was Jim McDermott got up and said, "I disagree with Netanyahu. I don't think war is the answer to this problem." Well, he never said war was the answer to the problem. So, you know, they were attacking him, man. I think that's why they were caught completely off guard by the success of the speech. And they shouldn't have been, obviously, because he's been successful before. But it was, I think they gambled that they could demonize him enough so that he would have to cancel the speech. And when he stuck to his guns, they were caught on a limb.
Yeah, and the other thing is, virtually every one of these boycotters emphasized the disrespect for Obama in the process that led to the invitation, that the scheming between Dermer and Boehner, letting the White House know, and then an hour, 2 hours later, extending the formal invitation to Netanyahu, and then the nonsense about how much time before the election. Well, the original invitation was for 3 weeks ago, which would have been 5 weeks before the Israeli election, which was longer than the time when Peres met with Clinton in 1996. So that one didn't fly, and there have been plenty of other meetings with other foreign leaders on the eve of their elections. And that's what the boycotters were saying. This was procedural. They thought it was designed to improve Netanyahu's chances to win at home, and designed to sort of drive a stake in the bipartisan process here, and to be dissing and disrespectful of Obama, which was particularly an issue for the Black Caucus, who sees every complaint about Netanyahu on every issue the same way Eric Holder sees any opposition to him. It's all racial when you get right down to it. So the substance, which is what Netanyahu is going to say versus what Obama's saying, was not emphasized nearly as much by any of the 50-some-odd who wound up boycotting. But the administration was aware that that was the problem. So the other two were smokescreen for them. Their problem was they knew that what was going to happen today. They knew that Netanyahu was going to walk in. He was going to be a rock star. The crowd was going to be sound like a Blackhawks game in the second balcony, which is what it sounded like when he walked in. And that's effective. I mean, people are watching this around the world. The speech became a much bigger deal because of the administration's opposition. And they see the Congress treating this guy like a rock star. He comes off as sane. He comes off as articulate. He makes a case. And the administration has to – I think they're reeling tonight.
You know, one of the reasons I think he comes across as a rock star is something counterintuitive, because he's a foreign leader. But we don't have a figure in public life in America today who celebrates American achievements in the way that Netanyahu does, in a public way, in a very simple and open-hearted way. When he said at the beginning of his remarks that he was glad to see Harry Reid on his feet, you know, in some ways that was a sop to the Democratic Party and a way of appeasing the other side. But in some ways, it really was just an affirmation of, hey, this is a leader of our country or your country. And, you know, he's been a friend of mine. And, you know, isn't it great? And isn't America great? And he did that last time also. When he opened his speech in 2011 with his congratulations on killing Osama bin Laden. And up to that point, there had been no other real public celebration of that fact. It was sort of something Obama did when he sort of spiked the football. But he was allowed to celebrate. The rest of the country wasn't really, because that would have seemed ugly or prejudiced against Muslims or something. When Netanyahu finally said, hey, you got your man, it was the first time Americans were allowed to cheer about it. So I think he did the same thing today, and that's why he gets the rock star treatment, because he basically comes out cheering for them. And I think people find it refreshing.
It's like American Sniper. People didn't expect that movie to draw 30 million people in the first three weekends. And why? It was an unapologetic movie that had a good guy and a bad guy, and our side had the good guy. And he was unafraid to describe the kind of people he's dealing with and to show his emotion about what they were doing to his buddies. And this was our team. This was somebody working for our team. What the mission was, a good mission or a bad mission, whether the decision to go in was right or wrong. It's okay to root for our side when they're in battle. And there was something of that, I think, today also. Because he, exactly like Joel says, he's very good at essentially saying words that make people feel good about themselves and their country and the alliance. And you know, people can talk about it, but he puts some meat on it when he talks about the U.S.-Israel relationship. And he does it in as bipartisan a fashion as he can, especially given the difficult circumstances today.
Well, that's for sure. And, you know, he also, I think, beyond that, he has a certain clarity of thinking that he is able to impart. You know, we hear a lot from the left about how Bush was black and white, a Manichean view of the world, no nuance. But, you know, sometimes there isn't nuance. Sometimes there are good guys and there's bad guys. So there's good and there's evil. And to not acknowledge that, to try to gussy everything up as, you know, some complex, you know, problem that only a liberal can solve because they understand all the ins and outs of it, that's kind of ridiculous. And I think it's so refreshing to find somebody who can speak to that black and white, that good versus evil, and do it seriously and do it effectively.
Mm-hmm. No objection
like
to me on that one.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to another administration talking point here, and it's, I don't know if it's the administration or even politicians as much as it is pundits on the left who make the point that this is not an existential threat to Israel, that Israel has nuclear weapons. So if Iran gets nuclear weapons, what does that mean? You know, mutually assured destruction, you know, all this other stuff. You know, what kind of an argument is that, Joel? I mean, is the Iran regime responsible enough, sane enough to be trusted with a nuclear weapon in a relationship with Israel where mutually assured destruction is the basis for the relationship?
Well, I think we have a serious problem with Iran's conventional weapons, not just the nuclear weapons. The deposing of the government in Yemen is a serious problem because it leaves an Iranian proxy in control of the gateway to the Red Sea, basically. So you now have Iran spreading throughout the region in a way that could choke off commerce, that could choke off travel, that could really have an effect strategically on Israel and on other countries in the region. And I think that that's something that is not going to be so easily undone, and that's what Netanyahu sort of emphasized, is that there's all these other things that have to be included in any peace with Iran. Iran's been able to behave as if those things don't matter to the nuclear negotiations, and Netanyahu put them squarely back on the table. But that's really a problem. It's not just that Iran could destroy Israel with a nuclear weapon or could give nuclear material to terrorist groups. The quality of life in Israel and in the region will change substantially if Iran goes nuclear, because it will take this empire and multiply its force substantially by orders of magnitude. And the other states in the region, instead of being free or nominally client states of the United States or whatever, will become essentially vassals of the Persian Empire, reborn in a much more sinister guise. And I think that's the picture Netanyahu started to paint today, but that's not going to be resolved even if the deal falls apart. I mean, the problem is the nature of the Iranian regime itself. And one of the arguments I think that it's very important to bring up is by Kenneth Pollack. Kenneth Pollack wrote a book called Unthinkable about war with Iran. He's opposed to war with Iran, but one of the things he said that the United States should be doing is trying to change the regime or encourage the regime's opponents through peaceful or democratic or internal methods. And he said, we missed a huge opportunity in 2009, and I think that we're understanding that now. But that's the nature of the regime is the problem, and that's not going to go away even if the deal falls through.
Mm-hmm. Michael Duran in his article makes the point that that was a deliberate pass. It wasn't one of those where they weighed and balanced, but the sort of courtship of Iran was already underway. And we did not want to be seen as essentially interfering in their domestic politics, especially when it was early on in that courtship process, which, of course, was all one way.
Yeah, Obama sending letters to Khamenei and not getting much of a response, or getting a sarcastic, denigrating response from the Supreme Leader. What was I go? Oh, okay. We got a couple of other issues. You know, Prime Minister Netanyahu is a politician. He's got an election in 2 weeks. I don't think he can ignore the effect this speech had on the voters back home in Israel. I'm just cynical enough to know that, or to think that Prime Minister Netanyahu had one eye on the Israeli voters and one eye on the U.S. Congress when making this speech. But what we've heard, it went over very well in Israel, but it probably didn't change any votes, did it, Joel?
I don't think it did, but I think that it...
Still there?
You still there, Joel? Oops.
Can you hear
still
me?
Connected. Yes.
Yeah, good. I don't know where I lost you, but I'll just start. I think that the Israeli opposition made a mistake by opposing the speech in the way they did. I think they thought it would be canceled, much like the American left had thought. And, you know, it's tough to be an opposition leader in these situations when your opponent goes abroad, the incumbent goes abroad. You know, it's considered unpatriotic to criticize them, but on the other hand, you want to propose an alternative to their way of conducting policy. I think he had another route here. I think he could have endorsed Netanyahu and said, you know, we approve of this speech and so forth, and still make the point about we'd have a better relationship with the United States if I was in power rather than Netanyahu, instead of which he just went full bore against the whole thing. And I think it makes him look petty now. I think he looks more and more to Israelis like someone who cannot lead the country abroad the way Netanyahu can. I think the moment this foreign policy crisis is over, Israelis will start to think, Netanyahu's been prime minister long enough. It's been 11 years or whatever. And you know, it'll be like Churchill after the Second World War, possibly, because the Israeli public is looking for something else in domestic policy. You might agree with that or disagree
Correct.
With that, but I think that Herzog did himself no favors.
Yeah, I would also add that, in general, Israeli politics is probably dirtier, nastier, more vicious than American politics. You have newspapers trying to get laws passed to prevent other newspapers from being distributed for free because they don't like any infringement on the level of control they historically have had over the political process, because they were the ones with the biggest circulation and as a result could make or break politicians. And Netanyahu has issues. I mean, there are lots of things for which he's not particularly popular. And I think there is also the exhaustion issue to someone who served that long, exactly like Joel says. So it's not a given. I think there's still probably a pretty fair chance that Likud will not have the greatest number of votes on the election, which means the left will get the first shot at trying to put together a coalition. And the problem for the left is the only way they can probably put together a coalition of 61 is with the Arab parties, which would be a first for an Israeli government to build a coalition that way. I don't think that's likely. So it could very well be that Netanyahu gets the second shot, which is kind of how things worked the last time, because last time Tzipi Livni had also a couple more seats first time through, but was unable to put together a coalition. So Israeli politics, with a small number of seats won by the dominant parties, the need to put together coalitions with lots of parties with 5, 6, 7 seats, it's not something that helps the country given essentially its international problems at the moment. But it is what it is. They had direct election of a prime minister for a while, which worked for three elections, and then they got rid of that. Now you're back to the situation that existed before. I don't think it's any healthier than having members of Congress have to run every 2 years and spend half their time out fundraising. It's good for K Street, but not necessarily for the American population. And that's kind of how I feel about some of these parliamentary systems. Britain works better because you only have three parties, really. Israel, you have seven or eight that are probably going to win seats this time.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I would think that any health to Prime Minister Netanyahu, the speech gave, would be in just the optics of it. The thunderous applause, the gushing praise by even, as I said at the start of the show, the left-wing commentariat that really thought it was a good speech. Fareed Zakir, or whatever his name is, from CNN, thought it was a brilliant speech. He didn't agree with it, but he thought it was brilliant. And I think that kind of thing plays a lot better to the aura surrounding Prime Minister Netanyahu politically in Israel than any specifics that you might want to pull out of the speech. Okay, so we want to get one more question in, and that's another question on sanctions. The barn door has been open for a long time on sanctions. When they signed the interim agreement last year, some of the sanctions were lifted. The international community is tired of them. They don't want to impose anymore. The president is not going to go back to the UN and get international sanctions anymore on Iran. Pray tell, Joe, what possible motivation then does Iran have to make any kind of concessions on stuff like the number of centrifuges, the quality of those centrifuges, because they are developing the next generation of them, not to mention their fissile material, which apparently the stuff they enriched to 20%, they shipped out to Russia and have promised to send the rest of it so that they only have 5% enriched uranium, which is suitable for nuclear power plants and medical purposes. I'm just wondering, is there any hope whatsoever that you're going to get a 10-year deal, that you're going to get a severe inspection regime by the IAEA? I'm just wondering if it's going to do any good at all.
I don't know that it will change, and I think that the difficulty with lifting sanctions to get into this deal in the first place is they're much more difficult to put back in place, because now a whole host of expectations have been created in the business world. You also had a certain amount of international unity that took a long time to build. That's now been fractured because the Europeans are not on board for another round of sanctions. And I think what you've got now, more than the stick of sanctions, is the carrot of the financial relief that would come from the United States, mostly, if all the sanctions were lifted, if certain assets were unfrozen and so forth. I think that Iran's major problem right now is the low oil price, which is something like a third of what their budget projects, which means their national budget is running into severe deficit. And they need a way to get cash infused into their economy to prevent themselves from hitting the kind of imbalance that ultimately brought down the Eastern Bloc in Eastern Europe. So they have an acute cash crunch. The carrot of getting cash into the country is really what the West has to work with. I think that new sanctions are going to be tough to put into place and will lack political credibility after they were withdrawn so quickly and rashly last year. So we're not at the end of the road yet. I mean, there are still diplomatic options available, but I think that we may be much closer to war than even Netanyahu let on today, because we're really so close to the edge. And Iran may be very close to a bomb, as Netanyahu said, but also the policy options have been severely curtailed by the work that Obama did to undo a decade of international cooperation. He claimed that he got the world together when he came into office and unified the world. It was exactly the opposite. When he came to office and took his new approach on Iran, he broke up the unity that had been worked on very, very, very carefully
by the Bush administration. And sanctions in the Congress.
That's right.
24 times. So he was, and now takes credit essentially for the sanctions that brought Iran to the negotiating table in 2013. But, I mean, I think Joel's point is right. The leverage is now on our side, but it's not being used. They need the money. We can provide it, and it shouldn't be for nothing.
Exactly. And with that, gentlemen, we have to say good evening because we've reached the end of our hour. I want to thank Joel Pollack, editor-at-large at Breitbart, for joining us tonight. Thank you, Joel. It was very enlightening.
Thank you. Always good to be with you, and hello to Richard. Always good to talk to Richard.
Yep. Thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
And thanks to my good friend Rich Baer of the American Thinker, political correspondent, for joining me again in the second chair. Richard, we'll talk to you very soon. And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.